Hi, David Feldman. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks,
You
Zach.
are, we connected on Twitter, didn't we? You're a fellow therapist, and I can't remember exactly what it was about, but we started chatting, and then I started looking at your work, your website, and your podcast, and your blogs, and all this amazing content about making relationships successful, marriages successful. And
Unknowing.
and so I've got loads of questions for you, but I think the thing that really piqued my interest was it feels like you're at the other end. You're kind of upstream from where I am, because I work a lot with men mainly who have separated from their partners, and they're in this quite grim place of still in conflict over child access and other things. So it feels like there's loads to explore, and I've got questions for you. But would you
Yeah,
like?
but yeah, vice versa too. I noticed that, first of all, I always appreciate connecting with other men in the manosphere, so to speak, and we all occupy a certain slice of the pie, so we're all, and what I think unifies us is our concern for men's issues and for, and as far as I'm concerned, men's issues are world issues. Men in so many ways run the world. And if we're not healthy and we don't have a healthy environment, including a wife and children and family, if we don't have a proper safe place to live and to raise our families, and that would include issues that you're referring to also, then the world's not healthy. I appreciate the work that you're doing as well. I tend, like you said, I tend not to focus more on, it's interesting that you call it upstream. I kind of call it downstream because I'm hoping that the men I work with don't get to the situation that you're dealing with right now. If you see it from that angle,
Yeah, that's an interesting, because I'm thinking, what is it, 50% of marriages fail,
end in divorce.
but yeah. And so it feels like I used upstream because it feels like you're getting to them
Oh, right. Okay, so we're
before
on the same
me,
page.
maybe. I'm getting
Yes.
to people who have kind of gone down the river and it's gone bad, and they're just
Right.
floating in the detritus and the debris of the river mouth.
Absolutely. Yeah. Which is a very noble life's work. So I respect the fact that you're doing that. I in some ways feel that my job is perhaps on some ways more complicated, but I definitely feel like it's easier because I'm approaching couples before the massive trauma has set in and before the damage has been fully done.
Yeah.
Whereas you're kind of like the triage at the hospital, the
That's
emergency
the word.
room.
That's the word. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a very interesting and difficult place to be, I'm sure. So
Yeah.
I actually, I know this, I know I'm quote unquote the guest in your podcast, but I'm very interested in hearing about also, so we can trade questions, but I'm very interested in hearing about, how you handle dealing with, what are some of the typical messages that men come to you with? So like, for instance, if you
Okay.
could
Yeah.
describe like what are some like the top three kind of movie reels that men are playing with and the most common traumas that men are having, not just about the kids. I know that's a particular issue and a particular social injustice, but when they describe their relationships, like what is it that men come and say, what happened?
The one that's coming up for me is I can't trust women. It's a deep wound, and maybe the mother wound, as it's known, but some kind of story around my ex-partner, my ex-wife, is attacking me with my child. This is a thing, the being that I love the most, more than my own life, and she has weaponized my child against me. how can I ever trust a woman again? And so that it's this, and then it's coupled often with this kind of red pilling of, I thought I was living in a equitable culture. I believed in equality, but what I'm experiencing is not the case. I'm going through family court and I'm realizing that this is not fair. These fathers didn't. It's a shock. It's not just losing a having your attachment to your child ruptured, but it's also your attachment to what you thought the culture was. So does that make sense? So they might say something like, I thought I was living in a world where, or let's just say, I thought I was living in a country in the UK where the police looked at evidence and you are innocent until proven guilty. But many times with family court process, there's accusations of domestic abuse leveled at fathers, and they have to be looked at, but it takes a long time. And in that time, contact is often blocked between the child and the father. So it's actually could be the average time from first hearing to say final hearing is about 37, 38 weeks. But there's been a massive backlog. So it could be a year or 2 years till final hearing. And in that time, if a child can't see the father, that's a massive impact on that relationship, on that attachment bond. And it's going to affect the child developmentally, but it's going to affect the parent, the father, in all sorts of ways that I can go into. But the story often I hear is that I thought I could rely on the authorities to be rational and fair, but I can't. So I've lost my trust in women, and I've lost my trust in this civilization that I thought was kind of more or less okay. Can't trust the police. I can't trust the magistrates, the judge. I can't trust the social services. And it's this very, the world is unsafe suddenly on so many new levels. That's where the stories are coming from that we're working with.
So it's a real shock to these men, meaning they're in addition to the trauma of their relationship going awry, they all of a sudden it dawns on them, probably some quicker and some more slowly, that their worst nightmares about estrangement from their child, and we haven't even talked about their assets and things like that, is going to come true. Basically, that they're going to be stripped of their relationship with their child, and there's nothing they can do about it. Is that what you're telling me?
That's the belief I often encounter. It's a state of powerlessness, because what they've discovered often before I get to them is the harder I try to fix this, the worse it gets. So say my ex-wife is not responding. I'm trying to go and see my child, and we've agreed that I'm going to see my child this weekend. So I travel to that town, I get accommodation, and then she's not responding. What's a person supposed to do? So at that point, the man may message more, try and phone her, maybe go around to the house. And then if this is construed as harassment, for example, it's difficult. It's almost a kind of double bind, because, you know, men, as I'm sure you know, I don't know if this idea resonates with you, but the idea of masculine archetypes, we have the sort of some deep programming to provide and protect and to master our emotions and to maybe take risks as well. And a normal response of a mammal and a human being when there's a threat to the child or threat to a loved one is to go into an activated state of anger and confrontation, or maybe running away, fight, flight. And in the man, that's often more of a kind of default. You know, it's like it's also to do with competition. You know, if you're fighting, if you're threatening me, if you're threatening my child, then I'm going to start to want to argue and challenge you. And that can easily be misconstrued as abusive behavior, when actually what it is a healthy response to an emergency. You know, the nervous system is totally activated at that point. And so these men, they
start acting like men.
They're acting like men and they're overwhelmed. And you know, that like other animals, they would probably be quite happy to, and they are happy to sacrifice themselves. So they spend crazy amounts of money on lawyers and barristers. Often their health deteriorates with chronic stress. I've seen men with, one guy was losing his sight in one of his eye. One guy had Bell's palsy on his face, like one side of his face wasn't working. Another guy had Crohn's disease, which is kind of digestive. It's just all classic sort of systemic chronic stress symptoms.
Right.
One guy actually had a heart attack.
I'm getting a lot of anxiety just listening to you speak about this subject, let alone.
I can't remember what your question was. I think I've just gone off on a tangent.
I'm sure there's an ocean of conversation and tragedy that we could discuss, probably story after story that you've heard from men. That's just heartbreaking, you know?
Right. And it's not, it doesn't have to all be negative. And maybe that's a good way to segue into where you're at, because what got you into focusing on marriage?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I've always been a very relationship oriented person ever since I was a little kid. I always like to tell the story that I believe I was like somewhere between 8 and 10 years old and blueberry picking with my family. Here in the States, we have something called blueberry picking. And what that is in Michigan, which is a little bit north of me, there's rows and rows and rows of trees that have blueberries. So you go and you pay your little money, you get a bucket, you go pick for the afternoon. It's a lot of fun. Anyway, so one time I was up there with my family and my mom and dad turned around and they couldn't find me. And so they were looking between all these trees, where's their son? And there I was speaking to this young newlywed couple all about I must have been 10 years old. I asked them about their relationship, how they meet, you know, how are things going, what's going on, you know, their living arrangements. I was 10 years old. And my father at that point realized that I was like very big into family and relationships and talking to people about their situation. So I've always been that way since I was a young boy. But I actually started after I got married, I opened up this, you know, I started working in technology, which I did for about 20 years, which I still do to this day. But around 40 years old, I decided, I'm 54 at this point, but around 40 years old, I decided, you know, I had been sitting in an office staring at a screen, you know, writing software code for as many years as I had wanted to. And I needed to do something that connected me with other people. So I went to my local graduate school, got my master's in, you know, counseling and family and marriage therapy, and began working in this field and started doing this. I wouldn't say full-time, I do it part-time, but I just have a passion for working with people and helping people have great marriages. Because I really believe that it's possible. That's the thing. I may be a fool, but I honestly believe that every man can have a loving relationship with his wife. And that it's hard work, but it's not complicated work. And I like to bring you know, insights, knowledge, skills, and practices into the public sphere that men can adopt and men can use, and women too. A lot of my clients are women, that bring them closer together in trust and honesty and authenticity, you know, all the good things. Because we are born to connect. We're born to be husband and wife. God took, and I'm a religious person, so when God created human beings, we were actually one. Adam and Eve were actually one being. And God realized that this wasn't going to work. If you can imagine being totally one with a woman, it just wasn't going to happen. We need some private space.
Polarity.
And so God carved out a piece of Adam and created Eve, right? And the idea was not that they should go their own separate ways, like MGTOW, right? That wasn't the idea. Or feminism, which, you know, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. That was never the intent. The exact opposite, that we are supposed to come together and learn how to unify. And in that process of unification, become not only closer, but better people ourselves. And this is something that's available to, this is God's gift to each and every one of us.
Yes. And you've been married for over 25 years. So you know what you're talking about.
I try.
I found in one of your blogs, I found this little passage that I'll just read out that really resonated with me. You wrote, "I wear what I have given up on my marriage. Sorry, I wear what I have given up on in my marriage as a badge of honor, courage, growth, and commitment. Because the more I let go of these things that I've defined as me, the more I can see and love my partner for the beautiful woman she really is and connect with her soul to soul." Can you say more about the giving up on things?
Sure, of course. Yeah, that's you know, sometimes my blogs are just, I just feel like when people read it back, I was like, did I actually write? So, you know, in today's society, it's all about me, right? I mean, that's just the definition of today's society. Me, right?
Yeah.
And there's so many messages. A lot of times my blogs or my spaces or my tweets are out to combat typical relationship messages that I feel are faulty and that I feel are do us a disservice. So in this particular piece that I wrote, it must have something to do with letting go in general, the whole, you know, the whole name of the article, but the idea is that oftentimes we look at what we're going to get in marriage or how our wives are going to help us be who we want to be. You know, what does she add? What does she bring to the table? What is she adding to my life? What utility does she have for me?
Yeah.
Right? How can she support me?
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not out to say that a person should definitely.
David, can I just, there's a little bit of a rustling. I don't know whether it's your mic is.
Is that better?
I mean, I can hear you fine. It was just like a background rustling. I don't know if it's.
I think it's on my shirt. Okay, there you go. I'll hold it out like that. Is that better?
That's much better. Thank you.
Okay, good. So in so many ways, we're really attuned to and focused in on what we can get out of our marriage and how our partner can best contribute to our lives or add to our lives, right? And if you think about it, you know, from a spiritual perspective, marriage is the joining of two souls. It's actually, according to Jewish mysticism, we're actually one soul that was split in half and put into two separate bodies, right? And God says, okay, this soul's going to go over here, masculine, and this half of your soul is going to go over here, feminine, and I'm going to drop you on earth somewhere, and there'll be this whole long story of how you two get together, but ultimately, you'll find each other, your soul will know, that's why we call it a soulmate, And then you're going to spend the rest of your lives fighting it out, trying to figure out how you two are going to get along, right? Now, the bodies can be completely, in so many ways, different. They can be different cultures. Obviously, they're different genders, but they can be different cultures, different languages, you know, different historical backgrounds, different family backgrounds. They can be anything, right? God's not racist. He could put souls in any combination. So the goal of marriage is the unification of your husband and wife as one. But how do we do that? How do you take something which is square and something which is round and bring them together? So obviously there's so much that could be talked about, but in this particular post, what I'm referring to is, in order for me to unify with my partner, there's a lot of what I have defined as me that I have to give up, because I can't approach my partner as this big, prickly, kind of disjointed, you know, creature and expect her to fit, and vice versa. So I need to, you know, shave down a little bit here. Some people say I have to shave down a little bit here. Some, you know, I've got to remove this piece about me. Maybe I have to work on my ego. Maybe I have to work on my pride. Maybe I have to work on my self-centeredness. Maybe I have to work on my anger, my kindness. Maybe I have to work on expectations of what I thought a wife was supposed to be. Maybe I have to work on a lot of things that I had previously defined as me. And I have to say, okay, I'm willing to let this go for the sake of us. And when I let something go, I say to myself, wow, that's amazing that I'm able to do it. I took what I defined as myself and what I was stuck with, an area of my life that I couldn't let go of, and I set it free. And I do wear that as a badge of courage and a badge of strength.
Right. Yes. And as you alluded to at the beginning, there's many people in our maybe public intellectuals or therapists who make content. I'm thinking of Teal Swan. Have you heard of Teal Swan?
Yeah.
She says something along the lines of, there's no unconditional love. You know, you have to get clear on your conditions. Otherwise, it's never going to work. And that appealed to me. But I can really understand what you're saying as well. I have to go into this union in the spirit of not calculating, not trying to strategize how I'm going to get my needs met. And that sounds like an act of faith rather than an act of a kind of magician's calculation of, yeah. Have you heard of the kind of Neo-Jungian masculine archetypes model of thinking about masculinity? So king, warrior, magician, lover.
Yes.
And yeah, so in the magician energy, we would be trying to stay safe, mainly. That's what the magician is all about. And he's trying to keep us safe. And so he would be going in saying, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if she's going to give me what I need. Has she got, you know, has she got the right amount of assets, or is she too needy, or this or that, or is she going to expect too much from me? And what you're kind of describing is more like the kingly energy of, I'm here in service to the realm, and the realm maybe being the family that we're going to create together. And
very true, very true. And I do want to go back to what you're saying. I think this is all very important point. You know, and I love the idea that it's multifaceted. Yeah. So you'll see it on my blog in general at davidfeldman.com. You'll see that there's all different angles that I look at. You know, it's not one dimensional. And I do agree. I agree with this idea of, you know, love not being unconditional. I'm on board with that. I'm on board with love is conditional. Where I may disagree with Teal Swan, and I don't know because I have to check into that, is the conditions that we make should be minimally about ourselves. The conditions that we make are for the benefit of the family.
Yeah, so, there's a higher purpose. And that is the kingly energy of, I'm not doing this for myself, which this culture and American culture, I guess, is very self-absorbed, isn't it? And
oh yeah.
I was looking earlier because I had just before this, I was thinking about life phases. I don't know why. I think I was, maybe it was because I was reading your website and you were talking about you've been through different life phases. As you just mentioned, you were a coder for ages. And you said on your website, you're a community member, a friend, an employee, an entrepreneur, a teaching rabbi, a writer, a therapist, and a wakeboarder, which I thought was pretty cool. I'm a surfer, by the way. So I love the water.
Oh, nice.
And riding. Yeah. But life phases is an interesting lens to look at this. You know, Erik Erikson had his 8 life phases. And what you were just saying has reminded me that maybe part of the work with, there seems to be a problem here, doesn't there? You know, in a macro sense of the masculine and feminine don't seem to be able to find that balance that much. You know, some people are doing it. They're doing the work and they're making it work, but half of marriages aren't working out. So, and it's not just marriages, is it? It feels like it's relationships generally, and the antagonism between the sexes is around. I mean, I heard someone I really respect say that women's hatred of men is the most dominant force on the planet at the moment. I don't know if I agree with that, but I think there's something in it. And
I totally agree. You know, I would agree with that. You know, and what I feel is so sad is that most of the people that I work with, maybe you, that's what I was asking originally with you, like, what are the stories that people are talking about? So many of the problems that couples are having, in my opinion, are what I would call easily fixable. You know, most fights that I see between couples, it almost sounds like I can hit play and record and play and record and play and record for every person that calls me up. Now, every situation is a little different for sure, but I can tell you that if as a community, as a culture, as a nation, if we focused on things like gratitude, kindness, respectful speaking, you know, a more holistic, less self-centered understanding of what marriage is about, you know, how to set boundaries properly, the basics. I mean, I'm talking about like real basics here. I'm not talking about sophisticated communication methodologies or any of that kind of stuff. So many of these marriages would be boosted by 50, 60, 70% just in terms of their ability to get along. You know, that's the saddest thing for me. That it's difficult, because to be nice to somebody isn't easy, but it's not complicated. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to put a smile on your face and just ask your wife, how was her day? Like, you don't need to be smart to do that. You know, you don't have to be a genius to eradicate criticism from your dialogue. It's not easy, because all of us feel the need to criticize. So I'm not making it into easy, but it's simple. Once it's simple work, you know, you don't need to be you don't have to go to the 1950s to learn how to be a feminine woman who treats her man respectfully. You don't have to go to the 1950s.
That's almost a dirty word, being a good wife now, isn't it? I feel. I was talking to my stepmom about this yesterday. Who's teaching women to be good wives?
And exactly.
Even as I say that, I'm almost cringing. Saying that.
It's so funny, because when I gently bring up these topics on Twitter, I'm extremely careful not to overstep it, as much as I have overstepped my bounds, but I'm extremely careful. And then when I see a woman kind of respond, I always say to her, why don't you speak more about this? Why don't you share your opinion more about this? Why don't you tell, you know, I'm saying, but if a woman says in a positive way, or she responds with something where she expanding on my idea, I always encourage them. And I'm not alone. I think there's many, many people today that agree that it's going to be a woman's arena to fix this problem because men have been.
I agree. I think there's a silent majority and a very noisy minority that keep everyone in these polarized kind of adversarial positions. And actually, people don't really believe it in their own experience. It's just these constructs, these ideologies. And I think there's forces at work. And maybe this appealed to your, in terms of your religion, because I think religion or the lack of it has a big part to play in this kind of atomization and degradation of the love bond, you know, like stable, solid attachments in families and communities and wider and wider. It feels like we're not victims, but somehow we've ended up going along with this process that's just gradually passing everyone out and becoming more and more isolated. And it's more and more difficult to not act in those negative patterns because we're in survival states more often. You know, when we're stripped of our wider family and we have a difficult relationship with our partner and then we have a child and there isn't a wider family to support us, or if we separate and there isn't a wider family to kind of mediate that, as would have happened 2,000 years ago or
totally
200 years ago maybe.
Oh yeah. And it even happens in, I know that even in the more traditional Muslim communities or in the more traditional Jewish communities, you know, there are elders in the community, whether they be a man or a woman, who dedicate part of their time to helping couples deal with adversity. Yeah. And, you know, it's like we're missing the whole social structure. As a matter of fact, unfortunately, and you're in the field of counseling, just like me, I mean, the message is clear. If you don't like the relationship, then it's you go, girl, and find yourself a man who will treat you better. You know, it's just that's the message that's being taught, you know, in therapy school. And I don't know when you went to school. I don't know when you got your master's or your PhD in England. I finished my program about 10 years ago. So I still was part of that wave. It was getting very progressive at the time. I would shudder to think of what it's like today, but even graduating 10 years ago, there was a lot of.
Yeah, I qualified in 2018 and I had a few issues with the how gynocentric, how it wasn't radical feminism, but it was not far off it. Some of the assumptions and some of the way things were framed. And it wasn't just the tutors. It was like the cohort that I was in.
Of course.
And you know, obviously it's mainly women, isn't it? Becoming therapists. It's about 80% women.
Yeah, I was in a class of 20 kids. And like you said, there was two or three of us that were men. And that was
it. And it's not even... it's not about being a man or a woman. You know, my friend Martin Seeger, he's a psychologist in England, and he's written a lot of papers, really interesting papers on male psychology, and trying to shine a light on the fact that the maleness in suicide rates and homelessness and addiction and violence, being a victim of violence, has just been. There's been no research on it until recently, because it was just this massive blind spot. And he calls it, he developed this idea called gamma bias. I don't know if you've come across it, which it's a sort of evolutionary adaptive cognitive bias that we have. So men and women have this, and it's a functional adaptation in order to allow men to master their emotions, to do what needs to be done, to hold the perimeter of the tribe, to hunt scary animals and so on, and to sacrifice themselves in combat and so on. And so we've developed, the species has developed an ability for the masculine tendency to cut off empathy to the self and to other men. And so that's just the cognitive bias that creates this situation where, you know, there hasn't been any research into why, what's going on for men. Why are they much more likely to kill themselves than women? And it's only now just starting to be that some of that. I was at a conference recently. I think that's when you saw some of the slides that I was taking photos of, because it was more research in that field. And it's starting to happen now. It's really interesting. But there's a lot of resistance to it.
I'm sure, you know. And, you know, a part of it is, you know, back, you know, a part of that, that's one of the issues that I like to address, as you said, you know, the downstream or upstream. You know, a lot of us have, especially as men, we've kind of lost sight of what the purpose of marriage is. And that makes us vulnerable. You know, when we go into marriage, oftentimes what happens is that we meet a woman, Tinder, whatever, pick her up, even if you're set up on a date, and we have this great relationship, a loving relationship, and we really connect with this woman, right? And then, like, she wants us to get married. So we're just like, okay, well, let's just take this relationship to the next level. She's pushing a lot of the time, and we get married, thinking in our mind that, you know, our marriage is going to be an extension of dating. It's just going to be like even more, you know, close and connected. And I always like to point out that you may have that fantasy that that's the case, but the reality is very different. Marriage is a completely separate institution. It's a whole different modality of relationship. So the second you tie the knot and you give the ring and you tie the knot and you take your vows, you've shifted, whether you know it or not, into a brand new way of connecting with the woman in your life. Many men don't realize this. They just think everything's going to continue on. Just like,
can you characterize the difference?
Sure. In general, a woman looks at marriage as the beginning of life together that has the mission of family and growth and permanency, right? So she's looking at it from that perspective, meaning everything up till then was merely the playground, or what we use as the selection process to get to this point. Once you're in a marriage, well, we need to buy a house, we need to settle down, we need to have kids, we need to establish ourselves, we need to do things. And the guy's just like, I was just fine before this. And I don't need any of this. I have an apartment, I have a job. What are you looking at me for?
This is a little bit like, are you familiar with Rollo Tomassi's rational male idea of hypergamy? So this is like the moment when the female establishes her hypergamous, she consolidates.
I'm not exactly sure that that's the way he uses the word hypergamy, but basically we call it nesting. Yeah. Basically, she's nesting.
Yeah,
I call it nesting, but I'm familiar with Rollo Tomassi. In general, I thought the word hypergamy was this idea that she this is the feminine imperative he uses.
Yeah,
but hypergamy is more like her desire to always get the best deal that's available to her.
Best provisioning, best genes. Yeah.
Right. So that wouldn't, in my understanding, that wouldn't necessarily apply in this case, meaning she got you because she is hypergamous. But this is the feminine imperative. She changes the way, the nature of the relationship. And the reality is that she's right and we're wrong. She is correct. And we have just misunderstood what's going on here. Okay. It's like if you drag somebody, I remember drag somebody to a roller coaster ride and they think, you know, they were just on this ride over there, they're in the bumper cars, and they're in the little pool, and then all of a sudden a roller coaster ride, right? They think it's just gonna be like another ride that's in the park. And meanwhile, you know, their guts are coming out through their through their mouths, and they didn't realize that this is what's going to happen. And so many men are completely ill-prepared for what marriage is actually about. And we get hurt because we're not in tune with the mission. Mm. We don't look at it like a mission. We just look at it as an extension of where we were, but just maybe a little bit more intense. And so that's part of my message to men is like, marriage is the mission. There's a mission here. There's taking care of your wife. There's making her feel safe. There's building a family. There's establishing a home. There's building community. There's legacy issues that we're dealing with in terms of your children. Mm-hmm. There's responsibility that you didn't have before. There's serving God and your community. These are your mission, which your woman is looking at you to lead her in. Mm-hmm. That's what she wants. And that's what marriage is actually about. And if we're not on board with the mission, and we don't put that mission first, and we put her heart first and our relationship with her first, it's just going to take time. Every guy is a different time. I usually think right around the 10 to 12 year marriage mark, maybe 15 years, that's when he realizes that her and him are living in the same home, but living different lives. And that's when the pain really kicks in for many men, somewhere around their mid 40s, when they realize that what they thought they were married is different than what reality really is. And it hurts. And it's a big growth opportunity for men to step up into that new level of responsibility and leadership.
Mm. Mm.
And we get our hearts broken because we're looking at this woman and saying, hey, I just thought we loved each other. Right? I thought you loved me and I love you.
And what you're describing is so much bigger than that. It's the foundation. The relationship is the foundational piece, but then you've got these concentric circles growing out from that.
Exactly.
Not about me or her anymore. It's about the extension of our marriage outwards, and marriage totally. Communities, I guess, don't they?
Everything. It's and a woman naturally understands this. That's the thing. She thinks that you understand this. She thinks that we're all on the same team. You know, and we are just like, well, maybe my sex will get better because I'm married now. Or maybe, you know, we could share finances because she's going to be moving in and da 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 da. You know, like we take little things piecemeal. We don't even look at the big picture.
It's often the case, isn't it? As you said, that men don't really want to get married and don't, I mean, many men do, but, you know, I think this is maybe, is this true? Often men, more often than not, men aren't the ones pushing to get married and have kids.
Totally. Yeah. Why would a guy want to get married?
So the woman's trying to push that agenda on them, and they hold off for a sort of acceptable amount of time, and then they have to go, okay, cool, we'll do it. But they still have to go through these phases of like early prince, middle prince, late prince, king. And what you're describing is king. It's like, okay, it's actually not about me or my ego anymore. It's just about service.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that, you know, you're supposed to, everybody has to, look, I don't believe in, you know, martyrdom as a husband. That's not what it's about. You know, she's not Mother Teresa, and you're not, you know, the male version of that. We're not martyrs. We need to take care of each other, and we need to have expectations that are loosely met in our relationships, you know?
Yeah. Does this resonate with you? Because I feel as though there is at least this is what I'm experiencing. Some of it in my clinical work, some of it just by talking to other people, other practitioners or other men who aren't anything to do with this, but that there's a disdain for men and the male drive to sacrifice and be disposable. There's nothing wrong with that per se. It's a pro-social attribute of the masculine, how it presents itself. And so there's a self-respect that comes with providing and protecting and sacrificing, maybe doing a job the man doesn't particularly like. You know, 94, 95% of workplace deaths are men. And men don't have a problem with that per se. But maybe part of the, one of the problems here is that women are, men don't feel acknowledged and respected for their sacrifice as much as they maybe did 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so at a certain point, a man may get to the conclusion, a bit like MGTOW, the MGTOW movement, which is, I find, really depressing, but it's a logical progression from the point of realizing that, is this a fool's errand? If I'm just sacrificing and giving and providing and protecting, and all I'm getting is disdain in return, at what point am I just a fool? It doesn't work. It's not sustainable for the individual man if he can't get that mutual respect happening. And he's not in control of that. It has to be acknowledged what he's giving.
Very good point. And it, you know, there's so many, we need to have more of these conversations, because there's, each one of these deserves its own, you know, deep dive. You know, just to touch upon some issues that I'm, or some thoughts that I have when you describe that very present and very true phenomenon. First of all, the lack of relationship with God for both men and women is, in my opinion, direct correlation, if not causation. Because once we have disparaged in our own mind the role of provider and protector, the ultimate provider and protector, which is God, once we've said, no, thank you, or that's not necessary, or nobody's going to tell me what to do, or, you know, I deserve it anyways. Once we've adopted that internally, then when a woman looks at the man, you're just a microcosm of what God is to the world, to her. You're the provider and protector, which is, in the same way that she was taught to take God for granted, she's going to take her husband for granted, or the man in her life for granted.
Great point.
Yeah. And us too. In the same way, God demands respect. We treat God respectfully. We treat the position of God, the thought of God, respectfully, all of us. You know, we dress nice when we go to temple or to church. We speak, we don't take God's name in vain. We don't, you know, there are certain behaviors that we do when we're in the presence of a religious ceremony or person. If men have given up on that and say, that's not for me, then all they're doing is shooting themselves in the foot, because then how can they command respect from another when they're not willing to give that respect to the one above them? So for both men and women, the lack of the presence and respect for God is very harmful. That's number one. The second issue, we can talk, that's a whole podcast if you want. But another one is that, you know, I have an article on my website about Does She Desire Me? It's called. And one of the principal topics that I love to share with men is one of these ideas that I talk about, and I tweet about it quite often, is that, I know this is going to sound a little strange, a little radical, and I'd like your opinion on it, but that men should never be running around searching for respect. Could hear me out. What I mean is follows. That, and this is, I think, a core issue, and I'd love to hear how you take this in terms of a psychologist and kind of a, maybe you want to use the Jungian prototypes, or archetypes rather. I always tell men, do not concern yourself with whether or not she respects you. That's between her and God. Only concern yourself with whether or not you're being treated respectfully. So I don't really care about the way you think about me. I only really care about the way you treat me. Being treated in a certain way is something in your control. How you feel about me, I can't control. But how you treat me, I can control.
Boundaries. These
exactly.
Are... Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes.
And to me, that solves a lot of the problems that many men are having in their relationships. See, those lines are often blurred. And I work a lot with men on learning how to, first of all, learning how they're being mistreated. Oftentimes men don't even realize that they're being spoken to in nasty ways, that they're being manipulated, that they're being verbally or emotionally abused. They don't even realize it. You know, I'll sit there on the phone listening to somebody's story and I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, like this guy, he's totally clueless. Like this lady's steamrolling right over him and he doesn't even realize it. And then he's wondering why his relationship's not working out, why he's unhappy, you know? So, you know, learning how to set boundaries and learning how to insist upon respectful treatment, that's something that anybody can do. And so men need to learn, first of all, what is respectful treatment and how do I create that in my own relationships?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that feels true for me. And I've had the same experience in my work with my clients. Sometimes it'll take them months and months to realize they're being shafted. And just this ability to hold, to maintain and carry on in a holding pattern, even though all their efforts are being, all their contributions and service are being just met with this disdain. That's the word that keeps coming up.
Right.
And then to, slowly see, hopefully see them come to the realization that they do have choice points. Like they are giving permission for this. They're actually acting as, you know, as party to this agreement, this contract, and they can change that. But often it's quite a sticky situation then, because they're in a groove. And in one case in particular, I'm thinking of this man, if he challenges his wife, she just goes nuts. She screams at him and attacks him. And obviously that's abuse. That's an abusive relationship, but it's just taking him a long time to actually grok how there is a gun to his head. And, you know, they've got kids and he knows if he wants to find a therapeutic solution, but he's been to two couples therapists and he felt really that he wasn't treated fairly in those situations. And maybe there's a part of that to do with him not feeling safe enough to actually share what's going on for him, because he still felt, even though there was a third party, that it was too dangerous to provoke his wife. He's trying to, it's a very scary situation and he's doesn't want to put a foot wrong.
Totally.
I don't know what my point is there, but it's about boundaries and it's hard to establish boundaries in a relationship where there haven't been them for a long time, isn't it?
100%. You know, that's one of the reasons when I work with couples, I do so separately. I do my couples therapy program, but I don't meet with them together.
Ever?
I wouldn't say ever, but what happens is, you know, the way my couples therapy program works, it's like I do three sessions with him alone and three sessions with her alone. And when people ask me why, and I say, well, why would I take a hungry lion and an angry tiger and put them in the same room with me and let's just see what happens, right? I don't do that. So I work with him so that he can be honest and
safe.
Completely safe, exactly. And same with her. Yeah, I have the craziest stories come up when I do this. It's like, I'll tell you an interesting story that, you know, it's just the craziest story. So I was working with this one couple, and the sweetest couple, they loved each other so much. They love each other so much. And, you know, when they came to me, they talked to me, they had a clarity call where they're both talking to me together. And it sounded like they had this problem or that that problem. It's not fairly typical. It's not like very typical problems, but they needed some help. So I set up my appointments and, you know, I got them on board and set up my appointments. You know, when he had his appointment, he said to me, he said, I know what it sounded like on the group call was our issues, but let me tell you what's really going on. And he talked about how, unfortunately, you know, the woman in his life would, you know, sometimes she would get drunk and black out and then start beating him up. And he says she didn't even know that this had happened. Like, she doesn't even know. Like, as he was telling me, he says, I'm like, have you ever mentioned it? He goes, I've tried to talk to her about this, but she has no recollection this is happening. So it's like, and then, you know, she's wondering why this other aspect of their relationship, maybe he wasn't nice to her all the time, something like that. It's like the complete, you know, crisscross of what's happening here. So I feel that in traditional couples therapy, where you're putting these two people in a room and you're saying, okay, let's be honest, I could spend a whole other podcast with you talking about like how that could easily go awry big time.
And it does. I hear about it all the time. These horror stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Besides for the bias of the therapist themselves,
I can't tell you. I had one client who was told in couples counseling with a female therapist that he should change his relationship to his employees. Because he was from a military background, and she somehow felt it was appropriate to start telling him how to. His attitude towards his work and things like that. And just.
Right. Just like... So, you know, there's, and, you know, the other thing I wanted to mention about this, back to the issue of the respect, is that because men, so originally we talked about, like, you know, the lack of godliness in the relationship and how that by default lowers our complete appreciation of what respect is all about. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is that because men are looking to her and dependent on her for approval and respect, right? They become completely at the whim of this other person, meaning they feel good about themselves when she respects me, and they feel bad about themselves when she has disdain. My philosophy in general, and this is such a gift that men have that women don't have, and this is an important point for men to understand. It's a gift that we have, which is, I can be your husband. I can be a great father. I can be a great husband. We could have lots of great lovemaking together. And at the same time, I'm okay with the fact that sometimes you're upset at me and that oftentimes you don't think I'm the greatest guy since sliced bread. I'm cool with that. I'm perfectly fine with that. Make sure that the house is clean. What was that?
That just feels so solid and grounded. And
yeah. And we can do that. We can do that once we let go. That's part of that. That's part exactly of that piece that you read originally. It ties it back to what you brought up originally. Once we let go of that need, once we say, I don't need you to think I'm Brad Pitt and everybody else in the most greatest thing. I don't need you. It's your gift. It's a gift to you. I know it's going to sound a little crazy, but it's a gift to you to feel that way about your husband. It's not about me. If you're in a marriage where you don't like your husband,
I get it.
That really sucks for you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there was a bit, I'll read another. How are you doing for time, by the way? We can wrap it up.
Yeah, this is good. This is good. We get a few more minutes and we're good.
Yeah, there was another, this maybe is from a different blog. There was a really nice bit about clean and dirty pain after, you know, grieving for a broken relationship.
Yeah.
I liked. But then there was a part where you mentioned your challenge. You challenge your clients with this question. Who would you be if your partner never gave you this thing you so desire? Could you still love them? What would it say about the way they love you? And then you go on to say, our limitations are a consequence of who we are as people and our inevitable differences as human beings. So there's always going to be a discrepancy between what our partner wants from us and what we actually are. And there's no shame in that. Exactly. And what you're talking about is holding the frame as a man and a husband and being okay with this is how I am. This is resonating for me at the moment, actually, because I've just something happening in my personal life. And it feels like I'm being asked to be different. And I'm in this inquiry at the moment. So when I read that today, I felt I thought, yeah, that's actually okay. I'm not a bad person. I have this limitation. Yeah, I can become withdrawn and disconnected at times.
That's like owning you're into Jung. So that's like owning your shadow. Right.
Right,
that's like
exactly.
That's like okay, you know, and so once men start looking at my marriage is up here, she is not your marriage. Your marriage exists outside. That's a huge part of the transition.
Right, that's a third entity. This is the project, the mission. You said, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and I'm serving that mission, and we're both in this together. And I'd like to make this as pleasurable for you as possible, like. But you're not, it's like me and you are trying to, it's like I always say, I give the example of two captains on a ship, right? The goal, when a captain's on a ship, the goal of a passenger on a ship is to just love the ship, right? That a cruise, let's just use an example for cruise. So the goal of the passenger on the ship is just to like love the ship. That's their goal, right? The goal of the captain on the ship isn't to love the ship. He doesn't give a crap about the ship. His goal is to get from point A to get everybody there from point A to point B. That's his only goal. He would love if his co-captain respected him and loved him and thought he was the greatest co-captain in the world, whatever. That's great. But that's not his goal. If his co-captain hates his guts, but he still has the job of getting from point A to point B, right? And the co-captain, they still have to treat each other respect. Again, always make that delineation. We always must treat each other with honor and respect. You know, but whether that co-captain like thinks I'm the bee's knees or the greatest person in the world or what, who cares? I don't care. Of course I care a little bit. But I care more for them than I do for me. Because I hate to be a co-captain on the ship and be stuck with somebody who you didn't like. Right? That would suck. And again, I'm exaggerating a little bit here, but I think it's a very empowering message to give to men, because men get very trapped in, does she like me? Am I doing a good job in her eyes? Am I being a good boy?
That's not it at all. Yeah.
I think that's related to male suicide. I think it's very related to male suicide because they feel like failures. Mm. They feel like I couldn't make this person happy, you know. I know it's more complicated than that because I understand the state has also created a horrible situation for men. And that's a whole other topic that I would love to get into as well. But there's so much that needs improvement, not enormous improvement, but just some fine tuning.
Right. And as you're talking, it is sounding quite simple. It's not like we have to go off and become more feminine and change our emotional processing patterns, which I think is quite a dangerous message to give to men. It creates a double bind often, and they're trying to hold the frame. They're trying to pilot the ship and being asked to take off all their armor and just collapse in a puddle on the floor. And
oh, yeah.
You can't do both, you know.
Women will never... This is another message for men that's very important. A man has the capacity to understand, at least on some level, what a woman's going through, but women will never understand what men are going through. They just won't.
Wow.
They can't. They just can't.
That's so reassuring to hear. I've never heard anyone say that before.
Oh yeah. See, they think that men are, you know, can be like them and be okay, because it's like, I hate to, you know, and I don't mean to speak disparagingly, but I'll just use this as an example. Mm-hmm. Like children don't understand why the father can't just take off of work and stay home and play, right? Like if he was only more playful, if he was only more relaxed about things, if he was only da 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 da. Now a father can understand why a child would think that way, and that makes sense, right? But until the child grows up and realizes that the man has on his shoulders this enormous responsibility that he's obligated in and all the ramifications of that, the child will never understand what the angle of the man. Eventually he will, because he'll eventually move into that position himself, right? So it's the same thing with the husband and wife. You know, men in their godly source are givers. That's the spiritual source that men come from.
I guess it's the son, you know, in ancient Greek or older, it's the idea of this constantly giving energy.
Yeah.
The earth is the feminine.
And the earth or the moon, like in Judaism, it's the moon.
Sorry.
The moon.
Sorry, yeah.
That's okay. The women are compared to moon because it waxes and wanes, yeah. And it, you know, never stable. And it's the but the main characteristic is that it's a receiver, right? The moon receives; it receives the light of the sun. Mm-hmm. So a receiver will never understand what it takes to be a giver. So we cannot listen to this. I wouldn't say it's not that we can't listen to, or we shouldn't take seriously suggestions of feminine. We need that. I meant to say a woman's power. Women have extra power that men don't. We can talk about that later. But in terms of how to be a man, that's not for them to say. How to be a better man, they can add that. They can add that to us because there's ingredients that we're missing that they have. But in terms of doing the kingship role that you're referring to, that's not something that they're going to have their comments probably won't really be that relevant.
And just say a little bit more on how it is that men can understand what it's like to be a woman and yet not vice versa. So we can.
Yeah, because we've been receivers ourselves.
Right.
Right. So we were, that's why I use the example of children. We grew up as being the recipients. Right. So, but there's a transition that men make. So we know what it means to receive. We know what it means to be powerless in that situation. Mm. We know what it means to be vulnerable and dependent. We know what it means to struggle for our voice. We know what it means to feel like we're always the underdog. Mm. Well, every man has had those experiences, right? But there's a piece of life that we have as men, you mentioned it so often, society projects this exact same feeling because we know it's true. Men's lives are disposable because there's an aspect of service that we have, of sacrifice that is demanded of the masculine, which is not demanded of the feminine and never has been.
It's almost as though masculinity is proven in the act of doing that. It's not a given. You can't just be masculine. You have to earn it.
Well, it's every man is masculine.
Sure. Yeah.
Every man has masculinity in their DNA. Every man is a leader in their DNA. This is a gift that God gave each of them. Every male lion has a mane and is ferocious and has big teeth and a lot of power. So every man is the same way. For whatever reason, as a therapist, you know, you could either look at the developmental model, the environmental model, the, you know, interpersonal model, whatever it is, there's ways to take us out of our base nature, you know? Mm. And like you said before, society today is doing a pretty good job of doing that, of unfortunately pulling out the rug from what it means to be a man. They're not really affecting us. In our nature, we're not changed. But the way we can express ourselves, the desire even to show up as a leader, the desire to show up as women today are complaining, you know, there's something horrible that happens on the train, right? And all these men stand around, right? They don't do anything, right? Women sit there and complaining, right? So it's like every one of those men on the train knows inside of them that they could pick up a fist or tackle the guy or all that kind of stuff. But for many of them, they're thinking to themselves, why bother? Or why should I? Or, you know, I'm not even know if this is the right thing to do in this society. You know, it's not that they're sitting there like women, they're not scared or feel powerless. They feel confused. It's a different feeling. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that rings true for me. And it's a deep, broad, widespread confusion. I think about the young, you know, the young boys and the adolescent boys coming up at the moment, and the messaging. I don't know what it's like in the US, but here in the UK, they actually, many schools are getting these organizations to come in and have workshops on how not to turn into a rapist and how not to be sexist and not to misogynistic, and all this stuff about toxic masculinity is just being stewing them.
Such a shame, because it really is the exact opposite, and it would be wonderful if they could focus on the opposite, which is that true masculinity and powerful masculinity focuses on using the gifts of manliness to protect women and to create a just society and to have compassion for others and to defend and protect and provide. That's real masculinity.
This is the father archetype that Western civilization is built on, isn't it? And it's like there's been a war against it raging for a while now.
Yeah.
And
it's a war against God. You know,
I hadn't quite made that connection, but it really, it's really sitting quite well with me. And
yeah, we're basically saying that we don't want a father figure. You know, we don't want anybody telling us what to do. We don't want to be obligated. We don't want a father figure. We don't want to have roles and responsibilities. We want freedom.
And just to connect it with what you were saying, with the analogy with the child, understanding what it's like to be a receiver, and we get older and we become the giver. But in the transaction analysis, the child ego state is very much like what you're describing. I don't want to do that. Like, I'm not doing it. I'm not going to be bound by responsibilities or social convention or religious convention or all of this old, it's called the patriarchy in a really a negative way, isn't it? And
it's a shame.
Fascinating conversation.
Yeah, to be continued.
Good to meet you. Do you want to share a little bit about your where people can find your stuff? And
sure. Yeah. I'm easiestly found on Twitter. Just my first name, last name, David, D-O-V-I-D, Feldman. David Feldman. I'm sure you have a link to it. I have a blog, davidfeldman.com. I have a great podcast, Building Great Marriages. I do a lot of Twitter spaces. Everything can be found on my website. And I have a marriage program that I do with my wife, who's a relationship coach. So it's just really nice because, you know, the men get to share with me and the women get to share with me, but the women get extra time with my wife, and she does like mind, body, somatic healing, which is really nice for women because they oftentimes get stuck, like emotions and trauma get stuck inside their body. And they just, no matter how many times they talk to people, whether it's friends or therapists, you as a therapist, you may have seen this as well. It's like a woman just needs the ability to release it, you know, and oftentimes talking does work, but sometimes it's so deeply ingrained in them that my wife's work with releasing trauma from the body is very helpful. And so that's part of our program, which is run. All this you can find on my website. But yeah.
Yeah, that's the 12 session recreating intimacy workshop. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. It's about 17 sessions in total. Okay. Yeah. So yeah.
Great. It's been a real pleasure.
You too.
Thank you. Yeah. And maybe to be continued, I hope.
Yeah, for sure. I'm really interested also in what you're, you know, how you, you know, the message that you give to men and how you inspire them, and you know, do they have a second life after this? And, you know, can they ever regain trust? Or is it like just this like massive slide right into red pill, MGTOW, you know, like all that kind of stuff?
What I can say, yeah, just briefly, is in my experience so far since I've been running these groups. So I run a group and I see them one to one at the same time over about 12 weeks. And yeah, it's been really positive. So some of these guys have gone through just unimaginable, horrible stuff.
Right.
And yeah, the feedback I've been getting from them at the end is that they can trust women again, and they can let go of, it's really, I guess, because I use polyvagal theory in a similar sort of somatic way, just to get them to really feel, to develop their resources. So, you know, how do they get in their own lives? Everyone's got access to safety cues. It might be different for, you know, yours might be wakeboarding, but mine might, I just went for a swim in the sea earlier today, actually. And that's a big one for me. But, you know, not everyone can do that. But so the more they access safety in their autonomic nervous system, the more they can actually see what the behavior of their ex-wife or ex-partner is in a kind of systemic way. And it's less, right. It's less personal. And they, right. They can move towards forgiveness or indifference. If not forgiveness, then just sort of like, it's just a kind of, it's a phenomenon that's understandable on different levels. So it's, it's moving out of the victim, you know, the drama triangle, and just kind of not taking part in it anymore.
Right.
It's actually really, I found it personally really inspiring.
Good. And
there's also been a religious, I'd say spiritual piece that I haven't brought, I've just reflected it back. And what I've seen many times is that, and some of the guys have been, they've already been into their religion, but other guys have started to connect with something, some version of
the power
God, and then witnessing the other men do that.
Yeah,
it's been a theme that's come up without me pushing it. So
right,
it's really it's been reassuring and humbling, and it's full of hope. You know, so it's amazing. And it's that group dynamic, as I'm sure you've found, if you've ever done group work, there's just something right. about people witnessing each other on a journey that doesn't really need that much. It just needs to be facilitated.
Right.
But there's something so cathartic for everyone involved, including me as a facilitator.
Yeah.
So
good stuff. Yeah, really. It's amazing. And God bless you. I mean, it's really, you're really serving. I know it sounds strange to say this, but you're really serving an underserved population. You know, you're really attending to an underserved population, which is really amazing. Men in pain, you know, who gives a crap? You know what I mean? Well, I'm glad that you do. You
know. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Mm. Okay.
Okay. So next time, maybe I'll have you come, maybe I'll have like a podcast or something and have you come on where we can go into more detail about what you're doing, because I think there's a lot that men can gain from seeing, you know, the rainbow, you know, on the other end of the storm.
Yeah. That was one of the things that I was thinking when we were initially contacting each other is have a look. Yeah. Maybe some men can have a look at what the business end of it all going wrong looks like. Because it's like Jordan Peterson often says, get your fear behind you. If you're struggling in your marriage, it would be good to know how bad it could get if you gave up.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah. People don't realize that, you know, they don't, especially, you know, unfortunately women are that big, since they do tend to focus a lot on their emotional state right here and right now. They don't really realize how bad it can get, you know, after the courts finished intervening and they're, you know, stuck with, you know, babies on their own. It can be a pretty lonely life. So, and for men too, you know, it's important for us to realize, you know, we got to put a little fear back into people to kind of make this work and to kind of make sure that people are willing to take that extra step. Unfortunately, I work with some women that come to me and their husbands just aren't willing to budge. They wouldn't even speak to me on the phone. They don't realize that she's already plotting, you know, his demise, you know, and then at some point they're going to end up with you and say, well, I just don't understand what went wrong, you know? And it's kind of like, well, you know, you had a chance, you had a bunch of chances, you know, and not necessarily saying that working with a therapist or with me is necessarily going to save the marriage, but I just find it a shame sometimes when people don't take the situation seriously. You know,
yeah, I can relate to that personally as well. I've got some regrets about things in my personal relationships where I've been that guy, and I've been really humbled through doing the work afterwards to actually confront the reality, the truth of, yeah, I just didn't take it seriously enough.
Yeah, so I have an interesting article on my website called How to Lose Your Wife. And it's a good read. If you know, all my articles are pretty short, but they get a good punch. Anyway, it's a real pleasure, Zach.
Yeah, real pleasure. Thank you. And yeah, to be continued.
Amen. Okay, you take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.